From National Public Radio, this is Horizons. I'm Verda Mae Grosvenor.
My feminism influences how I practice my Judaism.
Why be second best and imitate men? Choose first best and imitate the Almighty.
Most of the women, in Israel, they don't care about advancement. They say, as long as we go out to work and we have to be back home and to take care for our family, it's enough.
We know the roles of Ruth, Zipporah, Esther, Lot's wife, and other women in biblical times. But what is the role of women today in the Holy Land? As the expression goes, ask two people and you get three opinions. Producer Adam Phillips went to Israel and traveled the length of this ancient land inquiring about the status of women. This edition of Horizons, Daughters of Zion, Women in Israel, examines the lives of women at home, in the workplace, and in Jewish ritual life.
Know yourself that every shepherdess has her own special melody. Know yourself that every blade of grass has a unique song, and from the songs of all the grasses comes the song of the shepherdess.
Bilvavi mishkan evne lehada kevodo uva mishkan mizbeach.
Israel is a place where 3,000 years of Jewish religious tradition encourages women to stay in the passive childbearing role, where the military and security situation is always tense, and where the legal system is rooted both in socialism and the Old Testament. All this makes for an atmosphere where feminists and their ideas are likely to get a cool reception. Still, that doesn't stop people like Gila Reisel, a Jewish-American teacher and songwriter, from coming to Jerusalem, the Holy Land's ancient capital, and trying.
I see feminism as a prophetic movement. It criticizes the injustices in the world, just like the prophets did, our biblical prophets, okay? There's the issue of divorce. There's the issue of work, equal pay for equal work. There's the myth that the Israelis have, which is a hard one to break, about women being equal. It's just a myth. So that's why I think that Judaism needs feminism. You know, some of the things that were right for a different society at a different time may not be right for this modern world. And feminism has come along to enlighten us about that.
Leah Shaktiel is a religious woman and a Zionist who lives in Yerucham, a small city in the heart of Israel's Negev desert. As a woman, she fought for the right to sit with the rabbis on her town religious council. Despite the fact that she fought for these rights, she considers North American-style feminism an intrusion.
If you come from America, you must be the wisest person on earth, and anyone who does not follow in your footsteps is simply a poor person who needs to be enlightened on several facts of life. Trying to implement something from one society to the other without even bothering to learn the uniqueness of the other society, I don't think that this is a very sensitive approach. Women will have their rights as long as it serves some other higher purpose. People want to feel, they don't want to betray themselves and become somebody else. I want to be me, and what I am is I'm Jewish.
Many Israelis and Americans often point to strong women like the late Prime Minister Golda Meir as proof that any competent woman can rise to the top in Israeli society if she's got the talent and the nerve. But a quick look at the raw numbers indicates that Israeli women are lagging behind. For example, of 35 cabinet-level ministers, not one is a woman. Although women make up nearly half of Israel's labor force, they represent only 6% of that country's managers. For every dollar that an Israeli man earns overall, a woman earns just 71 cents, and the gap seems to be widening.
I met few of them who has to blame their ability and not their sexual organs.
Nativa Ben-Yehuda began her career as an explosives expert, demolishing bridges and blowing up buildings for the Palmach, Israel's elite underground movement before 1948, and later went on to a high rank in the labor ministry.
In Israel, we tried to encourage women to go up in the ranks in the government, in the civil government, and they didn't want to, because it's inconvenient to take responsibility. You have to fight, you have to show yourself. And a male, his wife and his mother and his friends, everybody is nagging, 3 years in the same job, you didn't climb up. What's wrong with you? A woman, nobody nags her. And it's very convenient to stay in the same job.
Work is no great big thing in Jewish society. You know, Jews valued learning.
Dr. Daphne Israeli is a research sociologist at Tel Aviv's Bar-Ilan University, who specializes in women's issues.
As a sociologist, I look at motivation as a dependent variable. I say, what is there about the society that does not encourage or does not develop a strong desire in women for career achievement? And here you have to see another difference between American and Israeli society. Work to begin with is not as important a life issue whereby achievements are defined. In Europe, in the European communities, the women did the work. They supported the husbands who sat and learned. And in the ultra-Orthodox community, that is the dream. The women serve the men and the men serve God. And that's the way it works, you know, in the Zionist ideology at the beginning. The women serve the male pioneer and the male pioneer serve the state.
The image of the tough female Israeli soldier who serves the state with an Uzi submachine gun has long been a powerful stereotype abroad. But, like most stereotypes, it is more fiction than fact. Although Israeli women are drafted with men, they no longer fight. This is a myth left over from the days when they fought side by side with men in guerrilla units against the British over 40 years ago. Most of the fighters in those days were hardcore socialists, who favored sexual equality for ideological reasons. There was also a shortage of male volunteers at the time. All this changed after World War II, when Jewish refugees began to pour into Palestine from Eastern Europe and the Arab world. These newcomers solved the manpower shortage all right, but they had a different view of women as fighters. Nativa Ben-Yehuda rejects the idea that the War of Independence was a time to push the cause of equality.
You know so little about wars, my dear, dear friend. Battlefield is a time only for the war to be decided. It's not a time for making you rich, and it's not a time for making equality between the sexes. You do the job, and this is what we did. This is what it takes to survive.
Israel has been in a technical state of war for 23 years. In this climate, women's issues have always taken a back seat to military and security concerns on the national agenda, and men and women have traditionally been given very different roles to play in army life. For example, women are asked to serve only 2 years, while men must serve 3. Also, since men actually fight in combat and women do not, there arise differences in the way their respective contributions are valued.
When countries go to war, physical prowess and traditionally male heroism become dominant values. And the traditional sexual division of labor becomes reinforced. The army is a place where people get actually very good training. Women don't get the same amount of training and opportunity for networking that the men do. A few do. Research has shown that it has an impact.
Resentment about the situation is easy to find during on-the-street interviews in Jerusalem. Rachel emigrated to Israel from England and is about to begin her 2-year army service.
Well, I'm very well aware that I might be wasting 2 years of my time completely, as I know friends of mine have. They do very little. Those who rise to the top are often coming straight out of the upper ranks of the army. Politics, civil service, industry, all of those fields take their new recruits based on their army record. Well, since women haven't really got an army record to speak of, they start at an immediate disadvantage.
In Zionist socialism, sexual equality has really meant that the tasks that men and women do are considered equally important, even if what they do is totally different. And indeed, women in Israel have been just as appreciated for bearing the children as men have been for fighting the wars. For example, in the early 50s, Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, awarded motherhood medals to women for their 10th child. And although this custom partly reflects official sympathy with the Soviet style at the time, motherhood per se is still a supreme cultural value in Israel. Daphne Israeli.
In Israel, the payoff for motherhood is very high. When people meet, I mean, the first thing they want to know about you, are you a mother? And if you are not a mother, then they feel very sorry for you. All the holidays are family holidays. The society is geared in all respects to reinforce women's desire and motivation to give priority to family life. But women in return get various votes of gratitude for their contributions. And therefore, very early Israel achieved many benefits for women in law which Americans today have not achieved, such as 6-week leave with pay and up to 1 year right to leave your work in order to take care of the child and various other parental benefits. The idea is that a woman should be able to combine work and family life. But it's not that she should be able to climb as high as she wants. Society, neither in its ideology nor in its structure, was prepared for the idea of equal opportunity for careers.
This is an important place where feminists and Zionists part company, at least in theory. Feminism is part of the humanistic tradition with roots in the Enlightenment and the West. It puts the individual first. Zionist socialism, on the other hand, is part of a revolutionary tradition with roots in Russia, where the collective comes first. Historically, the State of Israel has expressed this ideology in a practical way by encouraging its women to have many children, in the early days to replace the Jews who were killed in the Holocaust, and now to avoid being outnumbered by the Arabs. There certainly is no shortage of babies on kibbutz, the collective farms that sprang up throughout Israel as part of the socialist Zionist movement during this century. Women on kibbutz are having 25% more babies than the national average. Dori, a mother of four, came from Los Angeles to her kibbutz in the lush green Galilee region.
As far as family life on kibbutz goes, probably it's as ideal as life can get. On kibbutz, you don't have to worry about money. There's no rent, there's no insurance, there's no if anything terrible happened and you needed an operation that would break any family anywhere else, it's taken care of. Children are really well taken care of and the environment is unbelievably safe.
In the early days of the kibbutz movement, during the 20s and 30s, having children was often discouraged because so much adult time was needed for defense of the settlements and for production. Later on, as the kibbutzes began to prosper, children were welcomed but were raised communally, separately from the parents. Another experiment in hands-on socialism. In the 1950s and 60s, as the desire for comfort continued to eat away at hardline ideology, kids were allowed to go live with their parents, and mothers began to request service jobs with flexible hours that would enable them to spend more time at home. This trend has continued until today, when sex roles on kibbutz have become strongly traditional. In fact, an estimated 80% of women work in service jobs like daycare and kitchen duty, quite a contrast to the heady socialist pioneer days of old when men and women worked together draining the swamps and clearing the fields of their new land.
My children are fourth generation kibbutzniks on their father's side, and each generation sees major changes in the role of women on kibbutz. We've gotten to the point now where I would say that the traditional female values of pre-feminist America are pretty much the rule of day here, more because the women have wanted it than because the men have forced them into it. You're free, or you're in a job where if you need to go to the store, you can go to the store, you can go visit your child. And the women tend to prefer those jobs, while they also grumble a lot about the limitations to their choice. once it becomes established, it's harder to get out of it.
For Judy, a trained nurse who emigrated to kibbutz from Canada with no children and no urgent desire for any, there is a lot to grumble about. When she applied to the kibbutz work committee for a production job, she was told, "You're new. Work in the kitchen, work with the kids, or stick to the cows."
I know some women who have found themselves to be very happy is working with the cows. I have a feeling that's not for me, though. I can't stand the smell.
At this point, the kibbutz work committee tried to reslot Judy back into the daycare job she had before working with the cows.
"Look, I love children, but I really want to have a change. You know, it's not that I hate them or don't like working with them, but I want something different for me. And a lot of women are only exposed to women roles, and then all of a sudden it becomes very frightening to go outside those roles. Some women are afraid to all of a sudden say, 'No, I can do it.' If a couple of women fail, then right away they'll say, 'It's not for women.' And it is very frustrating."
Nobody in Israel knows frustration like women who want to be divorced, but whose husbands either refuse to divorce them or disappear. In Israel, all matters of personal status, such as marriage and divorce, are in the hands of Orthodox rabbis, who follow strict biblical law, which says that only a man can initiate a divorce and a woman cannot refuse one. In most cases, divorce is mutually agreed upon, but many men have refused to grant a divorce out of spite or until they are paid off with money. And some have left the country for places like far-off America without giving a divorce. The wife of a man who does this is called an aguna, or anchored wife, because she is stuck and cannot remarry until he puts the rabbinical bill of divorce, called a get, in her possession.
"I don't know where I'm living.
It's that I don't have my freedom. I have the constant sense of not knowing where I stand. I feel possessed where I'm working, whether I'm sleeping, whether I'm waking, whether I'm walking. It's always with me. It just hurts so much, and I don't know what to say."
Rina Batsara is one of an estimated 10,000 or so anchored wives living in Israel. Rina has been waiting 12 and a half years for her husband to give her the bill of divorce that will permit her to begin afresh.
"If I were divorced, I would have a chance to maybe meet another man and get married and have a more happy life and then transmit that happiness to my children. Whereas right now, they're seeing me as constantly sad, constantly crying, passing it on indirectly to them."
Some women try to remarry in civil ceremonies in nearby Cyprus or Greece. But the legality of these marriages is not recognized back in Israel, where such women are considered adulteresses. Further, there is a stigma attached to any children born of such a union, because under Torah law, they are considered mamzerim, or illegitimate, and they and their descendants may marry only other mamzerim forever. Rina defines herself as a traditional woman, yet she blames the rabbis for all this.
"I don't understand how in the 20th century we can still have rules that are of the Middle Ages, of the days of Abraham, in this land, in this holy land, to make such hurtful laws for women and for children. I don't understand that. I follow the tradition. I follow Shabbat. I'm kosher. I keep the dietary laws of the Jewish religion, but not everything to the last T. Judaism is a very beautiful religion, and the principles are very beautiful, but the current day rabbinical courts, basically, they're afraid of the advancement of women. That's what I think."
Rabbi Matis Weinberg, an Orthodox rabbi and Torah scholar, well known for his learning, believes that the 613 commandments that the Jews received on Mount Sinai were written by God and not by man. As such, they do not change from century to century and must be followed to a T.
You must understand that to a religious person who takes the laws of Sinai as being divinely given, they're a fact of nature, just like any other fact of nature. You don't argue with a tornado, even though it's awfully unfair, and you cannot argue with a disappearing husband, even though it's awfully unfair. We have simply no way that it was given to us on Sinai of annulling a marriage. There is no way out of a marriage except through divorce or death. If a man disappears and there's no way of ascertaining his death, or someone disappears and we cannot force him to give a divorce, then there's trouble.
Rabbi Weinberg is quick to point out that one should not generalize from women's passive role in divorce to the idea that she is a second-class citizen in Judaism. The Talmud, for example, says that a man must honor his wife more than himself, and it's stated explicitly in the marriage contract that a man must satisfy his wife's sexual needs before his own. According to the Orthodox view, it is because women have such innate power that there is such a strong emphasis on modesty, called tsniut in Hebrew, or hiddenness. After a woman marries, for example, only her husband is allowed to see her hair, and that's why most Orthodox married women wear scarves or wigs. Also, all women are expected to wear elbow-length sleeves and skirts that fall below the knee.
When a woman has a special relationship with a man, when there's a special love between two people, they don't want it violated by strangers. The cheaper a relationship is, the less I care about how violated it is. Well, for instance, when we have somebody, even nowadays, who's looked at as being very, very special, perhaps the Queen of England, okay? We wouldn't expect her to go walking around in a miniskirt. Now, why is that? Because it exposes too much. This is a woman who is too special to be exposed. But we consider every single woman to be that special. And by the way, that's exactly the word we use, bat melech. Right? We call women basically queens.
I can be a queen in my house. Nobody sees that I'm a queen. I'm a queen nonetheless.
Tiberias, a small city on the Sea of Galilee, is one of Israel's four ancient holy cities. This is home for Chava Berg, an Orthodox Hasidic mother. For her, the traditional ways of modesty and home life have a deep meaning.
It's so much easier to be out there and to be somebody and to make a salary, to have a career, than to be in the house and to put all your energies into these children. But what? It's so much more rewarding to put all your energies into your children. Why? Because instead of developing one person, namely great big me, I develop 4, 5, 6, however many children I have, and my husband. And through her husband, who knows how many people she influences. Modesty elevates a Jewish woman. Modesty protects the dignity of a Jewish woman. Modesty allows a Jewish woman to be a woman without being a threat. A threat? A threat.
Leah Shachtiel, the religious Zionist who is dubious about North American feminism, is also doubtful of this rationale, and she has the political experience to back it up. When Shachtiel was chosen for a seat on her hometown religious council in a popular election, the rabbis on it refused to let her take her place, citing the laws of modesty. Reluctantly, she took the case to the Israeli Supreme Court, and she won.
They were trying to prove that I was not a modest woman. They were looking for physical exposure, and they didn't find any. The idea of physical modesty is actually something that hides behind it the more difficult psychological problem of dealing with the exposure of the mind of women. This is the real scary thing. Not your body, but your actions are visible. Your words are heard. I went around the barrier of dress and forced them to face the other issue.
Morning prayers for the new month begin at 6:30 at the Western Wall, called the Kotel in Hebrew, the holiest site in the Jewish world. Already, a group of 50 or so women called the Women of the Wall have linked arms and are approaching its dark ancient stones in order to read together from the Torah, the holy scroll of Jewish law, and to pray as a group. trouble is expected. For 3 years now, these women have met with violence and outrage on the part of Orthodox men and women who claim that tradition allows these privileges only to men, that these women are desecrating tradition and the holy site. Bonna Haberman, one of the leaders of the group, refuses to back down.
Judaism has not accepted women taking a public role in ritual life. We're doctors and lawyers, professors, prime ministers even, but we're not even counted in our own quorum of prayer. And we're now claiming that not only the right, but the responsibility to be readers from the Torah, to be counted in a quorum of prayer, to be part of the decision-making in the process of ritual law, and to create new forms of expression and celebration, like the new moon, and like the welcoming of female children, like a celebration of women's bodies and their process in pregnancy and in birth. It's time for us to express ourselves and to have input into Jewish life.
The women have been legally restrained from praying as they wish at the wall by the Orthodox male rabbis who run the Ministry of Religious Affairs, which has jurisdiction over the site. However, who is really in charge here is unclear, because this religious ministry exists within the secular Israeli government, which guarantees absolute freedom of religious expression. The women of the wall are taking their case to the Israeli Supreme Court, which must face up to the ambiguous nature of its own legal system when it decides the issue. Miriam Devorah worships regularly at the wall and has experienced the violence and the tear gas firsthand. As a feminist and a committed Jew, she's prepared to travel to the deep frontiers of her faith to find meaning in both worlds. A phrase one often hears in Israel, la'at la'at, slowly, slowly, surely applies here.
What does it mean when you look inside yourself and you start to read yourself differently than you've been taught from tradition? You look deeper. You say, hey, it's a clear white slate, and I can create these forms in all sorts of ways to give voice to what hasn't been articulated before. It's looking into the blank spaces in the text. It's really tough to have the stranger within your heart and know it's there, and also know you are in your land. You are a stranger in your land, you are in your land, and there are strangers in your land too. And how can we all live together?
Im Yesei Sam Rachok Velo Meyot Parisam.
Daughters of Zion, Women in Israel was produced and narrated by Adam Phillips. Special thanks to CBS News, the Israel Women's Center, John Hockenberry, Daphna Israeli, Alice Shalvey, and Connie Murray. Engineering by Jason Stelluto and Brian Glassman. Senior producer for the Horizon series is Donna Limerick. Production assistant Aileen Ellis. Executive producer Benjamin Davis. I'm Verda Mae Grosvenor. Funds for Horizons are provided by NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.